We have not finished with the basics of Vipassana yet. So yesterday we ended with when are we to observe? So we are to observe the five aggregates of clinging when they are present. And so the present object is the most important. Now, the next question is, how are we to observe? Now, you all know how we are to observe the five aggregates of clinging. Now, we are to observe so that we do not add anything unreal to the object and do not take away anything real from the object. That is how we must observe or how we must watch. So, in order not to add anything and not to take away anything from the object, we try to take the object as it is. That means we just take what it is and we do not think about the object, we do not reflect upon the object, we do not speculate on the object, we do not analyze it, we do not make judgment on it. But we just take the object as it is presented to us through the six sense doors. Taking the object as it is without any additions and omissions is in accordance with the advice given by the Buddha himself. Once an ascetic came to the Buddha. Actually, when he came, Buddha was on his arms round in a village. So that ascetic wanted to see the Buddha immediately. So first he went to the monastery, and when he was told that Buddha had gone out for alms round to the village, he followed in the footsteps of the Buddha. And when he met the Buddha, he asked the Buddha to teach him in brief so that he could go to a secluded place and practice meditation. And Buddha refused. Buddha said, "It is not the time for giving a talk or giving instruction on meditation. He is on alms round." So he rejected. But the ascetic was persistent. He requested for the second time, and he requested for the third time, and the Buddha turned him down again. At last he said, "Bhante, who knows what will happen to us, to you and to me, that we may die next moment. So please, teach me something so that I can, following your advice, I can practice." So Buddha gave him a very short instruction. But hearing that instruction, he understood what the Buddha meant. And so right away, he went to a secluded place and practiced meditation. And he became an arahant. But the unfortunate thing was, after he became an arahant, he wanted to become a monk. So he was in search of robes when he was attacked by a cow and was killed. But he attained arahantship, or he became arahant before he died. And so the very short instruction given by the Buddha was of great benefit to that ascetic. The advice given to him by the Buddha was, "Let there be just seeing with regard to what is seen. Let there be just hearing with regard to what is heard. Let there be just sensing as smell, taste, and touch with regard to what is sensed. And let there be just thinking with regard to what is thought of. So this is the advice given by the Buddha. So that means when you see something, you stop at just seeing, and do not come to the judgment that it is good or it is bad, or that I like it or I don't like it, and so on. So with regard to hearing also, when you hear something, you just stop at hearing and not coming to judgment that it is sweet, it is pleasant, or it is ugly, and so on. So this taught him to take the object as it is without any additions. And this he practiced, and since he had accumulated practice in his past lives, he was to gain arahantship just following this short advice of the Buddha. The Venerunya Naponika, in the book called The Heart of Buddhist Meditation, calls this kind of observing paying bare attention. And he explains bare attention in his book. He says, bare attention is the clear and single-minded awareness of what actually happens to us and in us at the successive moments of perception. It is called bare because it attends just to the bare facts of a perception as presented either through the five physical senses or through the mind, which for Buddhist thought constitutes the sixth sense. When attending to that sixfold sense impression, attention or mindfulness is kept to a bare registering of the facts observed. So it is just registering the facts observed without any additions of our own, without reacting to them by deed, speech, or by mental comment, which may be one of self-reference, that is like, dislike, etc., or judgment or reflection. So that means we do not make judgments on the object, we do not reflect on the object, we do not speculate on the object. We just pay a simple and bare attention to the object without any additions. The practice of bare attention, any such comments arise in one's mind. So if when watching the object, you have made the judgment as like or dislike, or you have made reflection on it, then they themselves are made objects of bare attention. So you make a judgment, this is good, this is better, this is ugly, this is beautiful. Then that judgment should be made the object of bare attention in its turn, and are neither repudiated nor pursued. So those additions or judgments you make, you are not to repudiate, you are not to reject them, and you are not to follow them, neither repudiated nor pursued, but are dismissed after a brief mental note has been made of them. So this is what we are doing at the retreat. So we take an object and we try to be neutral towards that object. We try to just see it, just hear it, and so on. So if we made a speculation on it, then that speculation is made the object of our attention. Then we will say to ourselves, speculating, speculating, or reflecting, reflecting, or judgment, and so on. So that is what the Venerable is explaining in his book. Okay, once again. You can summarize?
I can now translate literally.
Yeah. Now we can take the copying machine as an example of bare attention. So you make some copies and the machine can just make the copy and it cannot add anything which is not on the sheet, or it cannot omit anything that is on the sheet. So what is on the sheet, it copies. So when we pay attention to the object, we are like copying machines. We just copy the object as it is, without any additions or omissions. Or we can take a photographer or a camera as an example of bare attention. So a photographer can take the picture, but he cannot add anything to the picture, or he cannot omit anything from the picture, not like an artist. So when the artist is drawing a scene, then he may put in something he likes on the picture. He's free to do that, or he may omit something out of the picture. But a photographer cannot do that. His picture will be the exact copy of what is there. So in the same way, when we watch objects, we are just taking the picture as it is and without any additions and omissions. And it is easy to say, stop at just seeing with regard to what is seen and so on. But in practice, it is very difficult. You need a strong mindfulness and concentration to just take the object as it is. Suppose you hear a noise. Do you stop at just hearing the noise? Or you go over to saying it is a noise of a car, or it is a noise of an airplane? And if you are familiar with cars, you even know that this is the noise of a Toyota, or it's the noise of a Honda, and so on. So before we know what we are doing, we have already made judgments onto the object. So in practice, it is very difficult. But with perseverance and with strong mindfulness and concentration, it is possible. If you want to make a test, you can take a clock that sounds at every hour, say 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. So you listen to that striking and pay attention to the sound and see if you know that it is seven sounds or 8 sounds or 9 sounds and so on. So if you know that there are 7 sounds or 8 sounds or 9 sounds, you are not taking the object as it is. You are adding something onto the sound. This is the first, this is the second, this is the third, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. But if you hear just a sound and you don't know how many times it has sounded, then you are right in the practice of mindfulness, and you are taking the sound object as it is, without any additions. So when we observe the object at the present moment, we must observe so that we do not add anything unreal onto the object, and we must not take away anything real from the object. That means we must take the object as it is, without any additions or omissions, or we must pay just bare attention to the objects without the subjective additions. Now, what will happen if we do not observe them? if we do not observe the object at the present moment. If we do not observe the object at the present moment, if we do not apply mindfulness to the object, then we will always cling to that object. We will always like the object, or we will always have a wrong view about the object. So if we do not observe them, if we do not pay attention to them, if we do not practice mindfulness towards them, then we will cling to them. So when we cling to them, we think wrongly that things are permanent, things are good, and things are substantial. So this kind of clinging will lead to acting out, will lead to doing sometimes wholesome and sometimes unwholesome actions. And these actions will lead to reaction in the form of rebirth in the future. So if we do not observe them, we are actually prolonging the samsara or the round of rebirth. Now, we always say we want to shorten the samsara, or we want to cut the samsara, we want to get out of samsara. But if we do not observe the objects, if we do not apply mindfulness to the objects, we are doing the opposite of what we want to do. We are prolonging this round of rebirths, because if we do not observe, we will always cling to them, and when there is clinging, we cannot stop at just clinging, but we will go over to doing something, and then we get the results. So when we see an object, let's say a beautiful object, we are attached to it, we like it. That means we cling to it with attachment or with craving. Once we cling to this object with, say, attachment, then the attachment will always be with the object. That means when we see this object again, this object, we will see this object with our attachment inlaid in the object. Or if we recall this object, it will appear in our minds with the attachment inlaid, because we have invested the attachment in the object. That means actually we cannot put attachment in the object, but in our minds we connect these two together, and so it could be said that we have invested, we have put the attachment into the object. And that is what is called latency of mental defilements in objects. Again, we can take a photograph as an example of latency in the object. So when a photograph is taken, then the objects that were taken by the photographer on the picture. So you look at it next time, then those pictures will be, those things will be in the picture, because they are impressed on the paper, and you cannot remove, or you cannot make it look different. Now, the other day, we went to take a passport picture of ourselves. So there is a machine at the store. We have to put some money and then sit in front of the, I think it's a camera. So I sat down on the stool, and then they put the money, and then it took pictures. But I did not know that it would take four pictures, one after another. I thought that just by taking one, that it can, what do you call, produce four pictures. So after once, I thought it was finished. And then I see the light, I saw the light again, and then it took another picture. But at that time I was smiling. and then the next picture I was getting up. So those pictures are with me. So I cannot change those pictures, because once they are taken, right? So if I take those pictures out and look at them, I will see myself smiling or getting up or just the rose and so on. So this is a, like latency in the objects. So we put the attachment into the object, and so when we see the object again or when we recall it, then it comes with those the mental defilements embedded in the object. So if we do not observe them, we will cling to them, and when there is clinging, there is action, and then when there is action, there will be reaction. Now, what will happen if we observe them? This is the opposite. So if we observe them, then we will not cling to them, because we try to be mindful of the object, or we make mental notes as seeing, hearing, and so on. So when we make notes of them, or when we apply mindfulness to them, then there is no chance for clinging to arise, or there is no chance for us to cling to the object. So there will be no clinging if we observe them, if we observe the five aggregates of clinging. When there is no clinging, there will be no acting following the clinging. When there is no acting, there will be no reaction, and so in this way we shorten the samsara. In this way we try to make an end of this samsara. So when we do not cling to them, we see them as they are. We see them that they come and go, and so they are impermanent, and they are suffering in the sense that they are oppressed by rising and falling, and there is no control over them. And so we see them as impermanent, suffering, and insubstantial or non-soul. That means we see the three general characteristics of these objects. So when we see the general characteristics of these objects, we are well on the way to attainment of Nibbana. So if we want to stop this flow of rebirth and death, or if we want to stop this samsara, we must observe the objects, we must be mindful of the objects, or we must practice mindfulness. If we don't want the samsara to stop, let it go on and on, then we do not observe them, we do not practice mindfulness. So those of us who are practicing mindfulness are actually at least trying to stop the flow of the rebirth and death in this long samsara. Now, these are the basics of vipassana. So I'm telling you the basics of vipassana in some detail, because as practitioners, you need to understand the basics of vipassana so that you can practice even by yourself, and also you can understand that what you are doing is right or wrong. And also I want you not only to understand the basics of vipassana, but to be able to explain this to other people as well. Because you may have friends and they may want to know what you do when you practice vipassana, and I want you to be able to tell them the basics of vipassana. So it is important that those who practice vipassana know these basics of vipassana, what vipassana is, what we do when we practice vipassana, and when we observe, what must we observe, and why do we have to observe, when are we to observe, how are we to observe. So the what, why, when, how of vipassana I want you to know. So when you know these details of the basics of vipassana, then when you practice, then you can be confident of your practice, and you know what you're doing is right or wrong. So if you want a copy of this note, you can ask the staff for a copy. Now next, what is important is when you practice meditation, you balance what are called the faculties. Now the other day, when I explained to you about the phrase ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, I told you that there are components of this practice. So by ardent is meant effort. By clearly comprehending is meant understanding. And by mindful is meant mindfulness. So three components are mentioned there. And I told you that the sub-commentary said that we must take samadhi also. So we get four components of the practice. Effort, mindfulness, concentration, and understanding. And also I told you that we need confidence or faith also. We need to have faith in the Buddha and his teachings and in the practice. So altogether, there are five components of the practice. And these five components are called controlling faculties. And these five controlling faculties must be well balanced. One must not be in excess of the others. So I want you to know the names of these faculties in Pali also. So the first is Saddha. So it is faith or confidence. And the second is Viriya, effort or energy. And the third is Sati, mindfulness. And the fourth is Samadhi, concentration. And the fifth, Panya, understanding or wisdom. So I want you to know both Pali and the English translation. And when we practice meditation, these five faculties or these five mental states must be working together and harmoniously. So it is important that they are well balanced, because if one of them is working too much, then the other faculties cannot do their respective functions, and so the mechanism of meditation will not work. Among these five, the mindfulness is very important, and it is said that mindfulness should be strong everywhere. That means mindfulness need to be always strong. So among the five faculties, the three, faith, energy, and wisdom, saddha, viriya, and panya. So these three factors favor restlessness. So when you have faith, when you have confidence, then you are active, and you are like something floating with the waves. So you're shaking, something like that. Your mind is shaking. And energy, when you make effort also, there is some kind of restlessness. And panya, understanding also, when you understand the objects clearly, and when you see their true nature and so on, you become agitated actually. So these three mental factors favor agitation or restlessness. If the mindfulness is not strong, mindfulness cannot harmonize these mental factors. So when mindfulness is strong, it can protect the mind against restlessness, into which the mind may fall by the influence of those faculties which incline to it, namely faith, energy, and wisdom. So when mindfulness is strong, it can protect the mind from falling into restlessness by the influence of faith, energy, and wisdom. And also, it can protect the mind against lassitude, that means laziness, into which mind may fall by the influence of the faculty that inclines to it, namely concentration. Now, when concentration is too much, you tend to become lazy. Now your mind is concentrated, and so when mind becomes concentrated and it is not protected by strong mindfulness, then you tend to lose energy. So when energy level falls and concentration is stronger than energy, you begin to feel sleepy, or you begin to feel lazy. So the concentration favors laziness. But when sati is there, a strong sati is there, it can protect the mind from falling into laziness through concentration. That is why a strong sati is needed everywhere. Our ancient teachers compare mindfulness to salt in all dishes, and to a minister who is clever in all affairs. Now, in Eastern dishes, salt is an important ingredient. If something is lacking in salt, we say it is tasteless. Although nowadays we are afraid of salt, and we put less salt in the dish, and still we want it to be a little salty. So, like shaking salt in all dishes, we need mindfulness or sati in all in all activities. So sati is required everywhere. And it is also compared to a minister who can do everything, who can do giving advice to the king, who can do maybe fighting, and who can do other things as well. So that means that sati is like a prince here. So we need sati everywhere. We need a strong sati or strong mindfulness everywhere. And only with strong mindfulness can we keep the other components or other faculties in their proper places and let them do their respective functions properly. And when there is no mindfulness, there can be no encouraging of the mind when it is low in spirit, and there is no restraining of the mind when it is too active. But when there is mindfulness or sati, then it can harmonize the other factors, and so when it is fit to spur the mind, it would spur the mind, and when it is fit to restrain the mind, it would restrain the mind. So the among the five faculties, sati is the very important factor, and it is called in the heart of Buddhist meditation the harmonizing factor or harmonizing faculty, because it harmonizes the other faculties or other components of the practice. So among the five aggregates, if let us say saddha is too strong, then the other factors cannot do their respective functions. Now the function of effort or energy is exerting or supporting or encouraging. The function of mindfulness is firmly establishing. The function of concentration is not distracting, and the function of understanding is seeing. Now, when one of these factors is too much, is in excess, then the other factors cannot do their functions properly. So when they cannot do their functions properly, meditation becomes bad. So it is important that these five mental faculties be kept in balance. So when saddha or faith or confidence is too strong and the others are weak, then we must do something to make saddha less strong. And the commentaries suggested that we reflect on the nature of the things when there is too much saddha. And also, we are not to do the reflection that causes saddha to become strong. Now, a person who has strong saddha is happy with thinking about the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and so on. So if saddha is too strong and others are weak, then he must do something to diminish his saddha or faith by not reflecting upon the Buddha and so on. And the commentary said that here the story of the elder Wakali is the illustration. So the commentary just said this, but the commentary did not give the story of Wakali here. So So we have to find the story somewhere else. Now, this elder Wakali was first a lay person, and when he first saw the Buddha, he was so pleased with the beauty of the body of the Buddha. So he was very glad, and then he decided to become a monk, because when he became a monk, he could be near the Buddha and he could always see the Buddha. So he renounced the world and became a monk. And after he became a monk, he always stayed in a place where he could see the Buddha. And it is just what he did was just looking at the Buddha and then be happy. And so he did not study, he did not practice meditation, he just looked at the Buddha. Buddha knew this, but Buddha waited for his wisdom to mature. Now Buddha did not teach when a person's wisdom is not mature, because it would be a waste of time and energy to teach a person who could not accept his teachings. So Buddha waited for some time, and then when he knew that the wisdom of Wakali had become mature, he said to him one day, "Wakali, what is the use of looking at this stinking body? He who sees the Dhamma sees me, and who sees me sees the Dhamma." Although Buddha told this to him, he still looked at the Buddha. He still did not get away from that place. So he was he continued looking at the Buddha. So later Buddha thought, without giving him a shock, he will not come to understanding. So when the rainy season retreat was drawing near, Buddha went to Rajagaha, and then he drove away Wakali, saying, "Wakali, go away, Wakali, go away." So Wakali was not able to stay with the Buddha, and so he was very sad, because he did not get to see the Buddha for 3 months. So when he could not get the chance to see the Buddha, he decided to take his own life. He said to himself, "What is the use of being alive if I cannot see the Buddha? So I will throw myself down from the top of the mountain." So he went to the a mountain called Vulture Peak, Gijakuda. And then he was trying to throw himself down. So at that moment Buddha saw him, and then Buddha sent his radiant image to the elder Wakali. So when Wakali saw the image of the Buddha, he was glad, and so all his suffering disappeared right away. So when he was in that condition, Buddha preached to him one verse. So when he, after that verse, Buddha said, "Come, Wakali, look upon the Tathagata. I will drag you up as one extricate an elephant sunk in the mud." That is what Buddha said. I like that in Pali it's very good, but in English it doesn't sound very good. "Come, Wakali, look upon the Tathagata." That means look upon me. "Look upon the Tathagata. I will drag you up. I will take you up. I will lift you up just as one extricate an elephant that is sunk in the mud. So when he heard this, he was very glad. Now Buddha was calling me, and I get the chance to see the Buddha. So then he did not know where he was going, but he leaped into the air. And it is said that 1 foot was on the ground and one was in the air. And then Buddha, he got a lot of PD at that time, and then he practiced vipassana on PT, and while he was in the air, he became an arahant. So after he became an arahant, he bowed down to the Buddha. And later on, he was appointed the foremost among those who have strong faith in the Buddha. So this is the story of the elder Wakali. So when he had too much sadha, he couldn't do anything else. He just wanted to see, he just saw look at the Buddha. So Buddha had to shake him up, and then when that sadha becomes low, because he was sorry at that time, Buddha taught him, and so he was able to reach arahantship. What if we have too much sadha? There is no Buddha to shake us up. So we can reflect on the nature of the things. We can reflect that everything is impermanent, and so everything comes and goes. And also Buddha taught that although things may seem lovely to us, in reality all things are unlovely, and so we may reflect on such things to make our sadha become less, and also to avoid listening to Dhamma talks or reading books that could make our sadha become stronger. So by avoiding listening to the talks and reading books that would inspire us much more, we may be able to reduce sadha. So in this way, we manage to keep sadha well within the limits. Similarly, when effort or energy is too much, then the other faculties, faith, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, cannot do their respective functions properly. So when they do not function properly, then meditation will not bring results. And in this case, the commentary says that the story of the elder Sona should be shown. So again, we want to know the story of Sona. So we'll have to other books for the story of Sona. And you will hear the story of Sona tomorrow. Not today.